Welcome to the Fuller Tracy Monday Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording at 1:18 p.m. the Pacific Summer Time. Today is Friday, and it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes, and it's the end of July, so it's a good time to start thinking about some of the longer-term themes. Well, I thought we'd kick off today with the total value of bonds that have got negative yields. It's up to $15.88 trillion. Well, at the beginning of the week, it was just shy of 15 trillion. So it's gone up a trillion in a week. Well, I guess what's a trillion between friends? But the clear point here is that it has broken the sequence of lower rally highs. It's quite likely that we're going to see this trend persist and that the number of bonds trading at negative yields is going to continue to expand. I did think that this graphic from a week or two ago, in fact, I think it was the end of June, was particularly instructive because of the number of bonds that, of government bonds at least, that have got a yield of less than 1%. It's at 90% of all outstanding issues. That's an incredible quantity of bonds with very low interest rates. It's asking big existential questions about the outlook for the global economy. I do think that it is worth taking some time to look at some of these trends. So the 10-year yield is now back down to test the 50 basis point level, but the most important thing is that it has broken the sequence of higher reaction lows evident since March, and while there is perhaps a reticence to push the yield further lower, there is, I think, a conclusion among fixed income investors that we are moving towards negative interest rates, and the Federal Reserve has said they don't want to go there. But if they're not going to go there, then they're going to have to massively increase the quantity of assistance that they provide to the economy. Now, they have been doing a two-step and promising big and having to deliver less for a while now. That's the question, of course, is whether they will be able to continue to do that. The 10-year gilt yield has been trending downwards. Now, if we want to be very correct, the very short end of the curve, anything out to about 6 months, is still in positive territory, and the 10 years in positive territory, but the trend is clearly lower. And we also have a rather consistent downtrend. It was really, I think, quite tempting to think that 3% was a floor back in 2008. Since then, we've had a couple of big ranges below one another, and this trend persists lower. Everything from about 2 to 7 years has already got a negative interest rate. If we go back and think about the fact that we're up now to almost 16 trillion in negative yielding debt, it's worth considering that the 10-year in Japan is actually still in positive territory. So when we then think about the number of bonds that are trading with a negative yield, they're doing it without a lot of the Japanese curve. It's, in fact, the number of bonds with negative yields looks really quite similar to that of the UK right now. Of course, Japan is engaged in yield curve control, and that, I think, is something that we're going to see more of. Because if there's a reticence or a reluctance to take the short-term interest rate into negative territory, well, then you don't have much choice then to engage in yield curve control. That brings us back to the kind of policies that the Federal Reserve are engaged in. Because until quite recently, it looked normal that after an inversion, you would see the yield curve spread expanding. That's very consistent with a weak economic environment and a willingness by the central bank to cut by at least 300 basis points. Of course, they didn't have 300 basis points to cut, so they cut what they could. And now we're at the question, of course, is how can you have a big interest rate differential when the interest rate's already at zero? And there is a clear demand by bond investors for bonds, and the Federal Reserve is buying them, although perhaps not as aggressively as it had been. But what we have effectively is yield curve control. The yield curve hasn't gone anywhere for 5 months already. And this is very similar to what the Federal Reserve did with the repo market. They have said that they do not have a standing repo facility, but the reality on the ground is that they do have a standing repo facility, because if there is any sign of stress in the repo market, they are going to step in aggressively in exactly the same way they did back in October. And on that occasion, it required a swift injection of $500 billion, and they did it in a very timely manner. In fact, I think that is probably one of the reasons why they have moved with such speed to deliver a raft of measures on this occasion. We had a very similar condition with the commercial paper market. They've made available a lot more than was in fact needed. It's exactly the same with the corporate credit facility, and the size of that facility is upwards of $700 billion, but they really haven't had to do anything. And it's the same thing with the Main Street Lending Program. They've made a huge amount of money potentially available, but they haven't had to really engage in that, because the banking system itself has been reasonably robust and has been able to extend credit. Of course, that is the strength that the US economy has versus other places. But if we continue to stick with the fixed income markets, this willingness to step in and provide massive assistance, regardless of the fact that it is quite likely to be permanent in nature, it has helped to rescue the economy. But this compression in yields is truly global. It is not just in developed markets, it's also in emerging markets. So the Indian 10-year government bond yield has compressed from 8% down to 5.8%. It's at lows we haven't seen since 2008, and even then the narrows were in the region of 5%. So we've had a very significant compression in yields in India. There is very little worry about inflationary pressures. There are, but that is against a background where there are outstanding questions about the integrity of the banking sector, the quantity of and non-performing loans that's sitting on those balance sheets. And then obviously the rupee hasn't been the strongest currency in the world. So this compression in government bond yields is very much part of the commonality that we've seen right across the government bond sector internationally. Then when, for example, just to look at another part of the world, if we think about the Brazilian market and just simply look at some of the bonds there, well, there have been significant issues with the evolution of the virus in Brazil. There has been the clear volatility in the currency, but we've also seen that the 10-year yield has come in from 8% to 6.5% over the course of the last few months. So this is a truly global phenomenon, and that is why what's happening in China is so important, because we have got the exact opposite trend. Yields there are rising, and the yield today bounced from the region of the trend mean. Now, there's still a sequence of lower rally highs, and that's been evident since 2018. But this has been a very significant rebound in the yield, and it is completely out of character with what we see in just about every other significant global bond market. So, yields in China are rising. Now, is that because of inflation? Probably that's an unlikely scenario. Or is it because there is less faith in the Chinese government? Now, that's a rather interesting conclusion based on the fact that China has some of the largest foreign currency reserves, well in excess of trillions. So why is it that yields are rising if we do not have an issue? Well, the reality is that growth over the last decade has been bought with debt, and there is a massive quantity of debt outstanding. And then there is the clear question about the integrity of the currency. And this does bring us to the point about what exactly is China doing with creating a digital E, or an E version of the renminbi. They're now trialing a digital currency in four major cities, and these are huge cities like Chengdu and Shenzhen. So we're talking about cities that have got populations in excess of 10 million people. And they are looking at how they can introduce a parallel currency for the domestic market. Now, this introduction of a parallel currency is a very significant development. It's being sold as a way of, on the one hand, of trying to modernize the economy, of trying to be innovative in terms of the monetary policy, but it serves a number of purposes. The first is that it's going to greatly enhance the sovereign's ability to control money flow within the economy. Now, that's already possible because cash has been pretty much dispensed with in China. It's difficult to use cash, it's difficult to get cash, and then the majority of vendors don't want to use cash. So part of the reason for that is because of the range of counterfeit options, but also because the cost for a merchant to use an online facility is really quite low, and considerably lower in percentage terms than what vendors pay big companies like Visa and MasterCard and even Square in the developed world. So they don't have the same disincentive they've got a much greater incentive, to try to keep it simple, to use virtual money. Of course, that will also greatly enhance the social credit score. So that's another development. But the bigger picture here is that by creating a digital currency and then allowing people, or in really getting people to use it via the government-friendly companies like Didi, which is the Chinese equivalent of Uber, or the food delivery companies like Ulema, which is owned by Alibaba, or Meituan Dianping. These are obviously then ways that people will have clear access to goods and services, and will then be using this e-currency. But it is totally within the realm of the possible that then in just exactly the same way that Henry VIII took the content of silver in the coinage down, that China will do the same thing with its e-currency. And therefore, this is much more like a ration book than any kind of true value proposition. This is, I think, part of the reason why we're seeing a clear loss of interest in Chinese bonds, then a demand for hedges against the devaluation, whether it is overt or covert in China. We've definitely seen that Bitcoin has broken higher in here, and this is a very clear and so far sustained move above the psychological 10,000 level. I think it's also worth to, or at least certainly relevant, that when we think about the halvening occurred in May, where the reward for minting new bitcoins halved, that bolstered the limited supply argument. And every other time that's happened, we've had a significant run on the upside. So we're now starting to see that breakout, and that is, I think, bolstering the limited supply argument. But then we can also think about the fact that gold is breaking higher and is extending its breakout in renminbi ever since it broke north of the 9,000 level. It's been extending that advance. In our household, at least, we're very glad that we stocked up on every form of gold chain and findings for Mrs. Tracy's jewelry business last year in advance of this breakout. But the problem is that she's going to run out because can't get back to China. And even after raising prices, the demand for gold has certainly picked up. And demand for gold is likely to continue to pick up if Chinese investors are worried about devaluation. The other thing, of course, is that Chinese consumers have got a rather limited suite of financial products they can invest in. It's not simply, or I guess they are, in many respects, forced into speculation. And the just historically and culturally, people have tended to migrate towards property investment. They are obviously also looking at gold, looking at Bitcoin, and then when we think about the stock market, we've had some volatility, and there are outstanding questions about just how willing the government is to support the stock market. They certainly don't want a bubble, but they don't want to collapse either. So we've had these stabs on the downside. The downward dynamics within this range are much larger than the upper dynamics. That's not especially bullish. It's looking progressively more like a gambler's market. That's why I closed my longs. But I am worried about the outlook for China, because we have this clear assumption in Western commentary that China's going to be fine, that they've come through the coronavirus with flying colors. But when we think about the outlook for the global economy, then the fact is that China's food prices are rising. They have got very significant flooding right now. The locust population has been exploding on the upside, and that is also affecting the Chinese economy. The price of corn has broken out on the upside in Dalian, and this is a very significant breakout. And if we just simply think about it in percentage terms, in 2017 the price was 1600. It's coming up on 2400, and that's a 50% advance in a staple food item. So there is certainly the potential for food price inflation to remain a factor. And food price inflation was already moving higher. Well, you can also perhaps remember there was this story about 6 months ago how China was actively getting control of the locust infestation using drones. And at the time, I thought that that was complete nonsense. But it was never questioned by the Western media that there was that it was anything but true. Well, the fact that we have got prices trending higher now in a very dynamic manner, and that began at the beginning of the year and has persisted throughout, well, then this is not just about the virus. This is really more about the fact that you've got historic flooding, you've got an infestation of bugs, and then you've got the clear difficulty in bringing the harvest in when people are sick. These are significant challenges, and the reporting of challenges is something that you just do not get from China. And now we have got the situation where government bond yields are rising. Now, it would be something if government bond yields were rising everywhere, but they're not. They're contracting everywhere else except China. Now, that is a red flag. It tells us that we need to pay attention to that. And I know I'm laboring this topic, but it is something we need to pay attention to. The fact is that the renminbi was in fact stronger in here today, and it is strengthening through the 7 level. If investors are losing faith in the efficacy of the Chinese expansion, then China has to maintain the value of the currency. If they were to devalue the currency, capital flight would accelerate, and they simply cannot afford that. So that is something that is going to play out. But the continued upward trend in the price of gold, in renminbi and Bitcoin does suggest that there is a capital flight going on already out of China. And I think that that is an underappreciated trend in the global economy that is, I think, if we're going to think about what the potential risks are, that is one of them. Now, when we look at the rest of the world, well, we've had meaningful moves in currencies. The reality is that outside of China, then we have got this clear trend of dollar devaluation. But it was checked in here today because this comes right back to one of David's favorite topics, which was that there is no country wants a strong currency, but some need a weaker currency more than others. Now, Europe does not want a strong currency, and we did see some profit taking here, and not least because it's the last day of the month. But we have a short-term overbought condition. There is potential for some consolidation, but the most important thing is that it is clearly breaking the medium-term downtrend. So we're back in a euro-dominant environment. Then when we think about the Japanese yen, it also posted a clear downward dynamic in here today. So that has certainly capped the yen's advance in the short term. Japan has no interest in having the strongest currency in the world. But we also have to, I think, pay attention to the fact that it's got a clear upward trajectory to trading since 2015. So Japan is going to do whatever it can to try and arrest the uptrend. And the only thing that it can do is print more currency. Even in an environment where we had a significant pullback in the euro today, then the price of gold continued higher, and it pushed on to a new closing high in euro. Then it also pushed on to a new closing high in Japanese yen, and continues to extend the breakout from what is effectively an 8-year range. So that's, I think, a really quite significant development. What we have in fact got internationally is synchronized currency devaluation. It's not simply about the fact that the USA has had by far the most aggressive money printing mechanism, but rather that every country is involved in some form of currency debasement, and therefore there is the clear potential that we're going to see assets of limited supply continue to rise. That's the primary rationale for investing in gold. Silver prices were in positive territory in here today, up a dollar. That pretty much countermanded the decline that we had yesterday, but we've had a lot of volatility in the space of this week, an amplitude in the region of approximately $3. So this is a consolidation following what has been an incredibly impressive advance. The price at the close today is still double what it was in March, and this has been a very clear breakout from a lengthy range. And these breakouts tend to surprise on the upside. We are back in a new bull market for silver. And by the time this bull market ends, I suspect we will be at new all-time highs. But it's not going to unfold in a straight line, and it certainly isn't all going to unfold in the next month. We are going to see ebbs and flows, and we have to bear in mind that this is a volatile sector. There will be stabs on the downside, and it is also a sector that is prone to manipulation because it's small. When silver prices were back in the $15 area, you could pretty much have bought all of the silver in the world for about $100 billion. And considering the fact that the market caps of the largest companies are well in excess of $1 trillion, then this, I think, is a small market, and it generally is prone to illiquidity. Now, there is going to be more silver coming to market because of mining activity, and it does take time to bring mines into production. We're in a supply inelasticity market right now because mines can't simply be turned on. The silver mining ETF has more than doubled off the low in March. It is now back in the region of the peak from 2016. A large number of the silver miners are now also gold miners because they could not make money from mining silver when it was trading even in the region of $15. So that means that the only potential for silver supply to increase is as a byproduct of other mining activities. It's going to require these prices to be sustained in order to encourage additional silver mining investment. And even then, it takes years to bring new mines into production. So we're in, attractive area for the precious metals sector, because the discipline that was enforced upon the metals miners during the bear market was profound. The concentration on all-in sustaining costs is a discipline that has continued to be enforced. It means that investors have a clear view both on the cost of production, the cost of continuing production, and also the outlook for cash flow evolution. But it does look like we are back in a demand-dominated environment. Now, when we then think about where are we in terms of the purchasing power parity of gold, it has broken out on a purchasing power parity basis against a whole host of currencies, but it's still not there yet with US dollars. And it pushed on to significant new highs in here this week. That's above the peak in 2000. So we are now at a new peak in terms of the purchasing power parity basis relative to the peaks that were put in all the way back during the last big bull market that climaxed in 2000. I probably need to look at another kind of chart to get that history. But the reality here is we've got a very significant evolution, that gold is now breaking higher in a sustained manner. It's pushing on to significant highs on a purchasing power parity basis. Now, I think this is the more correct chart because it's on a daily basis, so it hasn't had the averaging effect. When we think about where the potential is, I think it's very likely we're going to see the price of gold push on to new all-time highs on a purchasing power parity basis. The first hurdle will be the peak from back in 2011, but there is an additional peak from all the way back in 1980, and on a daily basis, it wasn't sustained, but it was substantially higher than we'd seen previously. So now we're at a point where gold is just on the cusp of breaking out, and investors are worried about inflation because of this competitive currency devaluation. It's a very significant factor. It's helping to flatter the outlook for precious metals, but it's also a tailwind for all commodities. And when we then think about the continuous commodity index, it has rebounded and was in additional positive territory in here today. It's now pushing up into the overhead trading range. It's back above the 380 level, and I think quite likely that we're going to continue to see this advance. So there is the clear potential that we are going to have an inflationary cycle evolving. When we simply then think about what is likely on the political front, I think the clearest correlation that we have is with the late 1960s, that the student protests and the racial equality and social justice movements that evolved in the late 1960s, then the social unrest that they gave way to, that contributed to the political classes panicking, and we had debt monetization, where the central bank actively printed as much money as the government required. Now, we're on the cusp of that kind of evolution today. And there is a big election in the USA coming up this year. Now, we're obviously in a clear transition phase because the vast majority of populist uprisings over the course of the last few years have been right-wing oriented. And right-wing populists tend to be market friendly. Left-wing populists, they tend to be more about tax and spend. So it would represent higher taxes, but then a very clear incentive to try and increase social benefits and much, much greater government spending. Now, whether that entails things like free education, free healthcare, and more infrastructure in the USA is obviously a big determination on the global outlook for inflationary forces and the outlook for a much weaker dollar. So those are going to be very clear trends to pay attention to, but the commodity markets do appear to be already pricing in the potential. There is, of course, the scope that the Democrats may win the election and also capture the Senate. If they have got control of all three houses, then what we'll have noticed is a lurch from a right-wing extreme to a left-wing extreme. And this is the kind of activity we see when the status quo has broken, that it is the extremes of political discourse tend to grow in popularity. So having moved to the right side of the right wing, we're now going to move more to the left side of the left wing, and the rise of populism in terms of the progressive movement is a very significant development because we have not really seen a truly powerful left-wing populist movement get into power in this cycle. The closest thing we've seen was in Mexico. And in Mexico, AMLO has had to cobble together a very weak coalition so that the most aggressive portions of his electoral campaign were not put in place. One thing we have certainly seen, though, is that corruption in Mexico has been trending higher in a very substantial manner for the last year and since he took power. When we think then about where are we in terms of this overall market environment, what we've had is a big dislocation, and there is the short-term risk that we're going to have additional lockdowns. That's potentially the case in the UK. Certainly Australia has been locked down in a more aggressive manner, particularly around Melbourne. Certainly I've been in contact with cousins there, and one of my elderly cousins hasn't left the house in 4 months. When we think about one of the clear conclusions, then, it's that we've had the dislocation, we've had the very clear massive increase in accommodation, there are inflationary pressures rising, so commodities are responding. But then the big disappointment for investors has been that value has not been firing. And I think that's one of the bigger challenges that, wait a second, I'm not putting up the right type of chart. When, for example, we look at the value ETF for the Russell 2000, so small cap value, it has not pushed up and into the overhead range in an aggressive manner. Meanwhile, the NASDAQ, led by the big technology companies, has clearly pulled away to new high ground and was in additional positive territory in here today. In fact, the trend over the last 5 months has been particularly consistent, with a series of ranges, one above another, and it is now firming from the lower side of that range and coming back up towards the 11,000 level. Well, it's paused at 9,000, 10,000, and now 11,000, and if it's going to remain consistent, well, then the next area of potential resistance is going to be close to 12,000. So this is a bifurcation in terms of the commonality of the market. We have got a doubling down of bets on growth, and valuations have are continuing to advance. The FANG companies now have got a greater market cap than the entire market cap of the EU, which is an extraordinary phenomenon, considering that the EU is a massive economic bloc. So that is, I think, a clear indication that we have had an acceleration of the trend. And when we then think about it in terms of the logarithmic scale, the log scale has tended to be quite consistent. We've had these ranges, one above another. Now, we had the inconsistency with the range dipping down into the underlying trend, but then we've had the subsequent rebound. It's also important to highlight that this chart has got a 200-week moving average, which is a 1,000-day moving average, and the NASDAQ has continued to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average. Now, in order to clearly demonstrate a peak, it would need to sustain a move below it. The Russell 2000 is at an interesting level because it has not yet been able to push back above that 1,000-day moving average. It has, on occasion, dipped below it. So it is not beyond redemption in here, but it is going to have to do better than it has done, and the jury is still out. We can think about what is doing best. It is the cloud computing sector, and a number of those ETFs have got a strong basis of commonality. I've seen a number of charts and articles talking about the success of the ESG sector, which is environmental, social and governance. But of course, all of these technology companies fit into the ESG sector. So they are basically piggybacking on the success of the cloud computing sector. One thing that is clear is that the evolution of the coronavirus has been an accelerant. It has brought to the fore currency devaluation, the debt issues, the massive quantities of debt. It's also bringing to bear the fact that there are companies that would normally be doing well. But, for example, Kraft Heinz today had to write off an additional $3 billion in terms of its value, the intangible value that the company had attached to its brands, has been one of the causal factors in the significant deterioration in the chart. When we think about it, this is something that is going to weigh on a substantial portion of the market. CVS is another one of these companies where intangible assets exceed the value of the entire company. So it's still moribund and has not been able to rally. AT&T is another good example. And a number of the airlines are in exactly the same position, where they have been relying on the value of their brand, but the intangible assets are greater than the entire market cap of the company. And how are these types of companies going to be able to recover? There is just no way that that is logical. Then when we think about one of the clearest trends for outperformance before the crisis was the reliance on buybacks. But buybacks are now a thing of the past. The only sector that is engaged in buybacks is technology. And therefore, it is technology that continues to do well. All of the other sectors that had been among the biggest buyers of their own shares are no longer active, and they are conserving cash. And that is likely to represent a significant headwind for their ability to continue to rally. So we have got the weaker companies that are saddled with very leveraged balance sheets. We've got the stronger sector that are clearly levered to the evolution of the global economy and the digital economy overall. Then we have companies that are sort of in the middle, those that have got a significant reliance on the consumer, and a lot of those are right in the region of their respective trend means. So Starbucks has been trending downwards for a year, and it is right there in the region of the trend mean. Kellogg, another sort of big consumer brand, was unable to hold its move in here today, but it hasn't really gone anywhere for most of the last few years. These sorts of middle-of-the-road companies are very reliant on the ability of the economy to recover. And that economic recovery is very dependent upon continued accommodation on a fiscal and monetary front. And I do think that that is continuing to be the most likely scenario. The S&P 500 has been able to push back above the trend mean. And the advanced decline line for the S&P has also pushed on to new high ground. And that is supportive of the view that the majority of shares are advancing and on a day-to-day basis. As long as that remains the case, and particularly as long as it holds above the trend mean, we can give the benefit of the doubt to the upside. Of course, we're not going to be back in a clear trending environment until it sustains a break away from the peak at the beginning of the year. But this is encouraging action. The reality, though, is as we look further forward, we are in a bubbly phase for technology because the coronavirus is an accelerant and it is pulling forward sales from out in the future. And in that regard, it is, I think, very similar to Y2K. I think the biggest transition for the market is going to be when we do eventually get a vaccine in the market, because then the rationale for continuing to work from home, continuing to rely on the cloud, and reliance on continued support from the Fed will all come into question. I do think, though, that as we look forward, the biotechnology sector is likely to benefit from this evolution, and that the ability to create success stories in less than 12 months from nowhere is something that was deemed to be impossible as recently as February and March. This is a true testament to the pace of technological innovation, that we can create something out of nothing in such a phenomenally short period of time is really quite encouraging. It is a vote in favor of human ingenuity, that doesn't matter how big the problems are, that people can rise and succeed in developing solutions, but that we are going to have problems with the quantity of debt that's outstanding, with the pace of a competitive currency devaluation, and as the quantity of bonds that have got a negative yield continues to rise, and as more countries approach the zero bound in terms of interest rates, eventually we're going to get to a point where there is a revolt and that there is a demand for some form of hard money. Now, there is a lot of competition out there in terms of opinion, but what usually happens is that a country is forced to give up its position as the reserve currency holder, and it is a matter of course that there is a clear, strong contender to take over. The reality today is that the USA does not have a strong contender in terms of a country able to take over as the reserve currency holder. China certainly has ambitions, but I think that the risks there are much higher than people are willing to countenance. And I think with that, I will leave you for the weekend, and I'll wish all the best to all of you.